Hello, I'm Mitchell Stein. This is number 0462, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0462. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back talking about a study that lets us know the most psychopathic places in the United States.
I think the study's groundbreaking because studying forensic psychology back in the day, and even today, we talk about this, how it would be really interesting if we did measure and see where the psychopaths are in this country. So it's a big step in the fact that somebody tried to do it. We've documented it. We know there's at least a little theoretical background behind this whole thing. And then they created a new number. They're giving you numbers like 1.89 and then 3.48. What do those mean? Well, those are percentage rates per capita.
Nevada brothel owner Dennis Hoff has won a GOP nomination in his state.
What they're concerned about is that I'm not a part of the establishment team. I'm not going to get involved in the pay for play. They can't break me, they can't buy me, and they hate it. Roger Stone, Donald Trump's advisor, came out to Pahrump, Nevada, and said Dennis Hoff is the Trump of Pahrump. He's a reality TV star. He produces a television series. He's a businessman. He's an author of a bestseller book, The Art of the Pimp. He likes pretty girls, and he's very flamboyant. So there's a lot of comparisons there. I think I'm just part of the new Trump movement of businessmen that will try to get into office.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. This special edition of Book Banter, I look back at summer readings past with a selection of some of my favorite paperbacks. So get out that dog-eared Bantam or Signet paperback. We're going to the beach or the balcony shortly on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0462 was Mitchell Stein, a Montreal-based communication and marketing student who is currently working for the Walt Disney Company at Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida. He also launched a Disney-based entertainment website, The Mickey Mindset, at MickeyMindset.com. That's very, very popular. So I'm guessing that Mitchell is somebody who's definitely going places. Thank you very much, Mitchell, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that is also a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Two Akron, Ohio Fire Department firefighters, Arthur Dean and Deanne Eller, are on paid leave pending an investigation into allegations that they created pornographic videos in an Akron fire station. According to Fire Chief Clarence Tucker, the station received an anonymous tip that the pornographic material was online. The firefighters were placed on administrative leave immediately following the findings. Akron Mayor Dan Horrigan and Chief Tucker released a statement, part of which said, "The city is actively conducting an investigation into the allegations, and we will take prompt and appropriate action based on the results of that investigation." The two employees were immediately placed on administrative leave pursuant to their union agreement pending the investigation. The employees involved are not assigned to work at the same fire station and were known to be in a long-term relationship. You know, there are too many firefighter-related jokes one could bring up here, talking about hoses and heat and fire poles, and also thinking differently about the title of the film Backdraft. But I'm just going to leave all that alone. But if this couple gets tossed out of the department, it would appear that they have a hot and heavy future ahead of them on several sites. Yeah. A Mississippi man is accused of beating a neighbor with a hammer and an axe handle for hiring someone else to mow their lawn. 39-year-old Brad Gentry had been paid to mow his neighbor's lawn, but stopped halfway through and left. Sheriff Ricky Banks said the neighbor, Ray Ferris, then went and got someone else to finish the task. Banks said Gentry came back angry and beat the hell out of the man and took $40 off of him. Gentry was charged with armed robbery and aggravated assault for the attack. Banks says Ferris drove himself to the hospital despite being struck in the head multiple times. The extent of his injuries is unknown. Well, there's no grazing in the grass here. I fought the lawn, and the lawn won. Security cameras outside a Pennsylvania home were rolling when an attempted truck thief was foiled by his inability to make a three-point turn. The Ben Salem Police Department posted a video showing the man attempting to steal a pickup truck, which had been left unlocked in the driveway with the keys inside. The man attempts to make a three-point turn around the car parked behind the truck, but repeatedly hits the other vehicle. The would-be thief eventually gets out of the truck and flees on foot. You know, I keep saying on this show that if you're going to be a criminal, at least learn the skills of your craft. I mean, if you can't do something right, don't do it at all. And a similar story is up next. A man was recharging his Nissan Leaf, that's an electric car, at a station in St. Louis, Missouri, when three people walked up and pointed guns at him. They said, "Give us your car and your money or we'll shoot you." The driver, only identified as Dan the driving man, gave them $40 and his cell phone, and the trio jumped into the car to drive away, but couldn't. "The car won't leave or go anywhere until it's unplugged," explained Dan. Once unplugged, the car still wouldn't go. Dan had the key fob tied onto his shoe. "When I step back, the car won't go without me," Dan says. So the gunman forced him to drive, but since the car hadn't been charged yet, it still wouldn't go anywhere. The carjackers fled on foot. "Turn yourself in. I forgive you," Dan said. "Sometimes you have to deal with the consequences that we suffer as a result of bad choices, but we can come back from that." Wow. My. What a forgiving soul, huh? Charges will follow. For the suspects and the car. And finally in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Pippa, the house dog at the Goat Island Lodge, located on a small island in the Adelaide River, just south of Darwin, Australia, didn't like the crocodiles that crawled out of the river at the lodge to be fed by innkeeper 66-year-old Kai Hansen. Visitors would take videos of the terrier, which had been nicknamed Dumb Blonde, chasing Casey, the croc, back into the water. Pippa had been doing that for about a decade. But the 1,000-pound monster had had enough. And it did what crocs do, said the lodge owner. It ate its tormentor. It was something that had a high probability of happening sometime, Hansen said. But he won't blame the predator. She's not doing something wrong. She's just doing what crocs do. Wow. Well, apparently it took 10 years for Dumb Blonde to learn what most dogs already know. Stick to chasing cars. They don't chase back. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? According to a new first-of-its-kind analysis ranking state-level estimates of psychopathy across the continental United States and the District of Columbia, the study has found that Washington, D.C. harbors the highest concentration of psychopaths in the whole country. The study also ranks the most psychopathic and least psychopathic states across the U.S. You know we have to discuss this. And you know the person we have to discuss it with is clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. And John joins us once again on the line from Texas. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program with us. Well, this is a new one, and I gotta say, from the get-go, from my own personal concern in my little corner of the world. I'm here in Montreal, Quebec. I am less than an hour away from two states. One of them is one of the five most psychopathic states, and one of them is one of the five least psychopathic mm-hmm. states. I happen to border New York and Vermont. My concern is actually for Vermont, which borders New York. Are you worried about the fact that one of the least psychopathic states is right next to one of the most psychopathic states?
No, for several reasons, but no, I'm not worried about that.
Okay. What do you make of, what do you make of a study like this? What does it mean, if anything?
Okay, well, you know, by training, I'm a clinical forensic psychologist. So one of the things I do as a forensic psychologist is I go to court and I get asked by the judges a lot of times, is this person a violence risk? And so what I do is I actually test and measure for psychopathy. And we use a test called the Hare Psychopathy Checklist. And it's very involved. It can take 6 to 8 hours to go through the whole thing. It's not a very short thing, but it's the gold standard we have. It's the best tool we have for identifying this. And the first thing I noticed is that they even tell you this, that they didn't use the gold standard. They used what they consider even a weak measure at best for psychopathy using the big five personality traits. And those are extroversion, neuroticism, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and then being open to experience. Now, you know, it's a great tool for things like therapy, but I would never walk into a courtroom with that because it's not going to be that accurate. It's going to be pretty low. But I think the study's groundbreaking because studying forensic psychology back in the day, and even today, we talk about this, how it would be really interesting if we did measure and see where the psychopaths are in this country. And you know, so it's a big step in the fact that somebody tried to do it. We've documented it. We know there's at least a little theoretical background behind this whole thing. And then they created a new number. They're giving you numbers like 1.89 and then 3.48. What do those mean? Well, those are percentage rates per capita. So for every 100,000 people, we expect roughly 1.89 or two people to be true psychopaths. That's kind of what the 1.89 means, those numbers. So it's not a huge percentage of people. That's really why I'm not really worried about it. If you think about for every 100,000 people, we're talking five or fewer people are psychopaths. That's pretty good, actually. And okay. We look at what psychopathy means. Usually when we think of psychopaths, we're thinking about serial killers. And serial killers and people who do that kind of stuff make up a very, very, very small percentage of all the homicides and murders that are out there in the first place. So we're already talking about a very small percentage of our population. So I'm not too concerned about it being right next to each other.
Okay, so basically, let's broaden this a little bit and just define what exactly is a psychopath?
Essentially, a psychopath is someone who has no consciousness, they have no empathy for human beings, for animals, living creatures. They may totally be enamored with and fall what we would think of in love with things like cars and knives and guns, inanimate objects that they would value more than a human being. And because of that, when they do work with human beings, they are only usually working with them because they have an object in mind that they're going to use you for. So you are a tool for them, and they will be nice. They will make you feel like you are the king of the world in order to manipulate you to get what they want done. And then they have nothing to do with you. And if you try to question that, not only do they have nothing to do with you, they may physically harm you or kill you or whatever. So, just think of the Jeffrey Dahmers and Ted Bundys of the world.
Well, what actually frightens me is I've seen studies in the past that talk about which professions psychopaths are most likely to be in, and I happen to be in one of those professions, so there you go.
But again, you're talking about such a small portion of our population that the likelihood of it is very tiny. And that's why, you know, when they kept the study going, they looked at all the states, and they said, wow, Connecticut was the most psychopathic at 1.89. So almost two people per 100,000 people have that traits of being a psychopath. Yet they went back and decided, well, let's look at Washington, D.C., because, you know, District of Columbia, it's not considered a state, so it's usually not connected and collected in these types of research patterns. So they looked at Washington, D.C., and that number was almost double what it was in Connecticut. And what we see with Washington, D.C., the nature of it was designed for our political and business leaders to be in one centralized location to run the country. And again, I have to go back to the soft measure using the big five personality traits to identify this psychopathy. What you have to look at is the fact that a lot of people in business do things that they don't necessarily like or want to do. For example, if your board of directors tells you you have to get rid of a division of your company, you know, you're responsible for going in there and laying all those people off. That behavior of laying people off would count as being psychopathic. However, you're not doing it because you're deriving joy and pleasure like a real psychopath would from that. You're doing it because it's part of your job. So with the big five, it's not isolating to see if it's part of your job or if it's just something you enjoy doing. So you get lumped in there in that group. So it may overrepresent psychopathy for the District of Columbia. And the other thing to think about is we send in this country all of our political leaders to Washington, D.C. So maybe we're pushing all the psychopaths into one location. So maybe we're safer as a state anyhow with them being there. So
now,
two ways to look at it.
We should mention, because I mentioned there are the top five psychopathic states and the top five least psychopathic states, so we should mention them. You already mentioned Connecticut being number one, king of the hill. Then there's California, New Jersey, and New York ties with Wyoming for fourth and fifth. And Wyoming and New York, I never thought any those two states had anything in common, but apparently now they do. Now, the five least psychopathic states were in order: West Virginia, Vermont, Tennessee, North Carolina, and New Mexico. I'm almost thinking now that West Virginia is going to put up signs at the border that says, you know, Virginia is for lovers, but we have less psychopaths.
yeah, but we're better to pick a date from because we have fewer psychopaths.
Exactly.
Crazy people. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, but what we see is the five states that are biggest, with the exception of Wyoming, are some of our most densely populated states. And when you look at Wyoming, you know, it's actually one of our least populated states. So what we see is those antisocial personality traits that may be popping up in the big five in, say, New York City and Hollywood and L.A., because of their density, people do that to protect themselves. When you go to Wyoming, there aren't people to be real sociable with. So it may have artificially bumped Wyoming up as well. So again, the big five traits is not probably the best tool, but I'm glad that they've done it because we've started down this pathway that my peers and I have been discussing for decades. You know, I wonder if there's a correlation with this and if there's a relationship. So then you look at the five that are least, and you see that, you know, West Virginia, North Carolina, New Mexico, Tennessee, those are all relatively southern states where, you know, you're trained as a child. Your parents did it. Their parents did it. When you're driving down the road, you don't know who the people are in front of you, but you're waving at them. You're being overly friendly because they're not as densely populated. You get a broken down car on the side of the road, you want somebody to stop. So you're going to be overly friendly, and you're kind of trained to be that way in those situations.
I'm just concerned, you know, with social media the way it is, and the fact that, generally speaking, as a population, we're sheep. A lot of people will follow what goes along. I'm just worried that this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You got people in the states that are most psychopathic saying, well, I'm going to start acting like it now. And you have people in the least psychopathic states saying, you know, we're happy and friendly, and psychopaths thinking, well, I'll just move there. More room to play.
Well, and that's a problem, you know, because a true psychopath, especially if they're average or above intelligence, they're going to be such a nice person to be around because they're going to hide their psychopathy until they need it, until they're ready to use you as their tool to get what they want. In fact, everybody, you know, if you talk to the friends and neighbors of John Wayne Gacy, he was a great guy. Now the family's like, dude, he doesn't care about anything. He doesn't care about anybody. He didn't take any time. He didn't spend time with us. You know, I'd have a big event going on at school and he'd go, yeah, whatever, and not show up as a father, you know? So you've got this psychopathy and intelligence, and they're the hardest to catch, the hardest to get into a compromising situation where we're going to see what's really going on with them. That is also kind of like what we see with our politicians, because they'll say one thing one week and the next week, oops, I can't say that anymore. They'll change 180 degrees and act like they never said the other thing before.
Well,
and that's very psychopathic as far as that's concerned.
Well, I can't wait for my next cross-border shopping trip to take this study with me and show it to the border guards as I drive across into your country. I'm sure they'll find it enlightening. John, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
I'm glad I got to do this today. Thank you so much, Peter.
Dr. John Huber, Chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0462, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll hear from Dennis Hoff, the owner of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch, who recently won the GOP Nevada primary for the upcoming election in November. Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter, and we have lots more Stuff File news and an idiot of the day coming your way here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a new Arby's roast beef fast food restaurant is opening in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in the location of a former Taco Bell. Meanwhile, half a mile down the same street, Taco Bell is building a new restaurant in the location of a former Arby's. It's nice to know the lengths that some companies will go in order to screw with drunks on late-night snack runs. That's just twisted. Wow. Meanwhile, car salesman Brett Bland in League City, Texas, finally had enough and filed a lawsuit in May against his employer, AutoNation Acura Gulf Freeway, and Jeremy Pratt, a co-worker. Pratt, the suit alleges, engaged in constant taunting, making extremely crass, vulgar, and rude comments, and reinforced dominance over his subordinates by regularly entering their enclosed offices, intentionally passing gas, and then laughing, as well as pinching and touching his male subordinates' nipples. Pratt was fired after sending a text to everyone at the dealership alleging that Bland was a sex offender, which he is not. After the firing, however, Bland's lawsuit alleges that AutoNation allowed Pratt to loiter at the dealership and continue harassing employees, and Bland was threatened with termination if he didn't sell 8 vehicles a month. Bland seeks damages and court costs. You know, there's nothing bland about Brett Bland, but there certainly is something truly Pratt about that Jeremy Pratt. Look up the word Pratt in the dictionary, and he most clearly fits the definition. A woman in China was stopped by police after being spotted driving on the highway in a slow-moving pink bumper car. Footage recorded on the highway in Jiang, Guizhou province, shows the woman driving a pink bumper car down the busy roadway while full-size vehicles sped past her. The woman was stopped by police and given a warning. Police said that they confiscated the bumper car from the woman. The woman, by the way, operates a bumper car business in the city. You know, I've actually seen the video of this, and while what she did is positively dangerous and reckless, I'm beginning to wonder if she was an idiot or a truly cunning business marketer. Meanwhile, resorting to a low-tech but possibly offensive strategy, Largo, Florida detectives visited a dead man at Sylvan Abbey Funeral Home in Clearwater and attempted to use his finger to unlock his smartphone. Linus F. Phillip, who made it only to the age of 30, was shot and killed by Largo police on March 23rd after he tried to drive away from an officer wanting to search him. As part of their investigation, police said they needed to access and preserve data on Phillip's phone. Legal experts generally agreed the detectives had not broken any laws, but Phillip's girlfriend, 28-year-old Victoria Armstrong, was less forgiving. "Nobody even called us to let us know detectives were coming there at all. It's very disturbing," she told the Tampa Bay Times. "I'm very skeptical of all funeral homes now." Well, they wouldn't get anything from me in a similar situation. I still have a flip phone, and there's nothing to hide. Oh, and it's rotary.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Florida woman was arrested after cops said she falsely called 911 claiming a medical emergency when she was just thirsty. It turns out that Jennifer Sue Roberts' emergency was a need for beer. The 57-year-old called 911 twice, just after noon and also just before 4 p.m., exclaiming that she had a medical emergency. Roberts reportedly appeared intoxicated when paramedics arrived after the second call. Pinellas County Sheriff's Office records indicate Roberts, who also reportedly goes by the name Jennifer Sue Sunday, has been accused numerous times of dialing 911 without an emergency. She's made 28 false calls since February. Gee. Is society allowed to take away someone's phone? You know, if the emergency line keeps getting harassed, I'm afraid the phone companies might make their standard pat answer to such issues and ask that 911 change their number. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in March, we talked to Dennis Hoff, the Nevada brothel owner of the famed Moonlight Bunny Ranch and the Love Ranch in Carson City. That was when he announced he was running as a Republican for the Nevada State Assembly District 36. Well, he just recently won in the primary, so now it's on to the general election in November. I thought that since he's now the official candidate for the November vote, that we'd have him back on the program. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo, Dennis. Thanks very much for being on the program, and congratulations on your primary victory.
Well, it was a big victory. It's the Nevada history. And what happened is I was able to knock out a three-time incumbent in a Republican Party that's a Republican in name only, tax hiker. And you can't do that in Nevada.
Now, a lot has been made of the fact that you, a brothel owner, are running and you won in the primary. I saw it on newscasts. I saw it on talk shows. It was discussed so many places over the last couple of days, now weeks, since the primary victory. But in reality, if you win in November, you won't be the only brothel owner who is in elected office.
How's that?
Well, Lance Gilman, owner of the Mustang Ranch in Northern Nevada, is a Story County Commissioner.
Oh, but this, you know, assembly job is way above that. I mean, there's no comparison.
Okay, so
he lives in a county where there's hardly any people, and it's not hard to get elected to something in Story County.
Well, what I'm basically getting at, though, is the fact that, I mean, here you are, a brothel owner, and they're making big hay about that, where we're talking about something that in the area you live in is a legal business.
Well, absolutely. And the fact is that what they're concerned about is that I'm not a part of the establishment team. I'm not going to get involved in the pay for play. You know, they can't break me. They can't buy me, and they hate it. Roger Stone, Donald Trump's advisor, came out to Pahrump, Nevada, and said, Dennis Hoff is the Trump of Pahrump. He's a reality TV star. He produces a television series. He's a businessman. He's an author of a bestseller book, The Art of the Pimp. He likes pretty girls, and he's very flamboyant. So there's a lot of comparisons there, and I think I'm just part of the new Trump movement of businessman that will try to get into office.
Now, since it is a state election and not one of a national election, this doesn't require you to, for instance, get an endorsement from the White House. Would you or could you get an endorsement from the White House nonetheless, or would that be politically non-viable because, quite frankly, of the business you're in?
Well, I would love to get an endorsement from Donald Trump. He'll be in Nevada on Saturday. I would love to have that endorsement, but I don't know that it could happen.
Now, we spoke to you last time when you just started running, so now the reality of you winning the primary is in our rearview mirror, and you're looking ahead to November. What does this mean for you as far as the opponent you're going up against and your platform for the election?
Well, we're going to shift gears, definitely, but this is a very red libertarian area. I mean, everybody's carrying a weapon, and it's one of those places that don't bother me because I got 100 guns. You're smoking a pound of weed. Leave me alone. I leave you alone. A Democrat really has never won anything in this district ever again, although I'm not taking it lightly because the Democrats might put a lot of effort into this, and a portion of the Republicans that can't buy me might fight against me.
So you've got people gunning for you on both sides then?
No question. No question about it. It's just like Donald Trump. The establishment doesn't like it that I'm coming in and messing up their sandbox. You know, that's the last thing they want is a guy that they can't control and they can't buy. That's what happens to all these politicians. It's disgusting. That's why we need term limits and we need more businessmen in there. I'm used to, for 27 years in brothels, 42 years in business in Nevada, I've been signing the front of paychecks. That's the kind of people we need, is people that know how to cut expenses rather than raise taxes.
You know, we've had you on our programs, either on this show or on my previous radio show, for years and years and years talking about brothels. We used to have you on every New Year's Eve, and you just mentioned yourself. You've been in the brothel business for 27 years, but in business for 40. I don't think I've ever asked you what you did before you were in the brothel business.
Well, I started out when I came to Nevada in gas stations, so I owned a bunch of gas stations, then it escalated into garages, towing companies, and I made a lot of money, and I put that money in real estate in Northern Nevada. You didn't have to be much of a genius to make a lot of money off real estate at that point. So then I got into real estate stuff, started doing more development of big hotel timeshare type properties, and then I got into something legitimate, prostitution.
So from gas stations to prostitution, no matter how you cut it, pumping is involved.
Judith Regan, my book publisher that published The Art of the Pimp, it wants to do a paperback now, and she wants to do a television series, and it's The Art of the Pimp, Prostitutes to Politics, where the real whores are.
Wow. Now, let's go back a little bit to the night you won the primary. You had a celebration. Of course, you partied because you won. Do I understand that you had Hollywood Madam Heidi Fleiss with you when you were celebrating your win in Pahrump?
Absolutely. Heidi Fleiss has supported me from day one. She's pounding on doors, talking to people. Her car looks like the Hoffmobile. She's been a dear friend for, gosh, 30 years and ex-girlfriend, and she's right there to support me. She was there with me. A lot of politicians, some of the pastors were there praying for me, and it was an amazing night.
As I mentioned, your brothel business and many others are in your area, in that area you're in, are legal, but there are those who want to turn back the clock and make them illegal. Is that part of the reason why you're running? Because it's some of your opponents who are on the other side of that issue.
No, absolutely, it's not. What happened is my opponent started all that in Northern Nevada and Southern Nevada. They're only trying to do that in the two counties where I have brothels. So he started all that. Now we've got to deal with it. Nevada's about freedom. You know, I moved here, and a lot of people move here because you can gamble 24 hours a day. I don't gamble. You can drink 24 hours a day. I don't drink. You can smoke weed 24 hours a day. I don't smoke weed. You can carry a gun. They don't want to be messed with. Leave us alone. The brothels are big taxpayers, and people just want to be left alone.
As big a taxpayer as you are and as successful as you have been as a brothel owner, I understand that you say you're downsizing your business by selling off some brothels to focus more on politics. Is that true?
I'm selling off some of them in Southern Nevada. And I sold one, and I'm working on another one. I'll probably keep one down there just so I can have a presence, a Northern Nevada, Southern Nevada presence. But, you know, it's a lot of work, and I want to put more time into helping the government and helping the people. It's a new chapter in my life. It's time for me to give back to the wonderful state that's made me so successful.
A lot has been going on over the last little while. It's, for between now and November is a lifetime in politics, but now that you've won the primary, how are the polls looking for you?
Well, they're looking good. You know, like I said, it's a very red libertarian area, and I feel real confident. Although I'm not discounting the fact that the Republican establishment is going to be against me and that they're going to work hard to make sure I don't get in office.
One of the things that's big in the news these days, of course, is the situation with what's going on the southern border. Even though you are dealing with state politics, you are close to that border. Is that an issue in your election campaign?
Absolutely. You know, now that I need to appeal to a wider audience, it's more about jobs, education. You know, we spend a fortune on education in Nevada and get no results out of it. We're a terrible education system. Jobs and the illegal immigration affects that. It affects it a lot because the illegals will work under the table for a lot less than the Americans can. And the other thing is safety. There's a safety issue when you bring in all these illegal immigrants. I feel sorry for them, but the reality is this. Don't come to our country and expect a free ride. And Donald Trump has finally enforced our laws. I know how Canada is. If these people were coming into Canada, it'd be a huge problem. In Mexico, it would even be a bigger problem.
But what about those who are not coming over the border merely for a better life, but the ones who are escaping violence and potentially death in the countries they're leaving?
Yeah, I get it. And we have to have compassion for them. But a lot of that, they know all the lies to tell, too. How can we vet them and make sure that really is a problem? And, of course, you want to help people that've got problems. They have to flee their country. But look, I've seen friends that couldn't even get into Canada because they had a drunk driving arrest in the United States. Vince Neil from Motley Crue couldn't come back to Canada for a while because he got caught with a Hustler or a Playboy magazine. So you guys are tougher than we are.
Not when it comes to refugees, though.
Really?
Visiting,
well, that's good.
Coming into Canada to visit is one thing. There are many rules that will prevent you from visiting. But if you're coming here to live and you're coming as a refugee, it's a little different.
That's great, but you also don't have you don't see your borders being crashed by Americans, thousands of them trying to come in either. They wouldn't let them just come in there and live there unless there was some kind of a political asylum.
Actually, that was called the draft during the Vietnam War. Yes, we had a lot of Americans. A lot of Canadians that I worked with were former Americans who were expats who came up here with the draft, and some of them finally went home because Jimmy Carter had an amnesty when he was president of the United States. But there are a lot of my friends here who are former Americans who came here fighting the draft.
Well, that's great. It's nice that you let them in, and we'll see where it all goes here. But the first time I voted was for Ronald Reagan. There was a million illegal immigrants in our country that came across mostly from the Mexican border. Ronald Reagan says, we're going to have them meld into society, treat them like family, and then we're closing down the borders. Well, that was, what, 35 years ago or something, 37 years ago? And they didn't close down the borders, and it's a real problem for our country. And so I'm supporting Donald Trump and his actions, and I have compassion for the people that are getting separated from the family, but they knew that they shouldn't have been coming here.
Well, your election is taking place, as we mentioned, in November, so it's upward and onward for you after the primary. We'll touch base with you come November, and we'll talk about this one way or the other, how it goes.
Well, there'll be plenty to talk about before then, because it's a big news story in America that a gentleman that can own a brothel, even though it's a little illegal business, has the gall to run for elected office. But I'm going to do a good job for the people. That's the only thing I care about is my voters.
Thanks for being on the program, Dennis.
Thank you, buddy.
Dennis Hoff, the owner of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch and the Love Ranch, just to name two of the brothels he owns and runs in Nevada. You can visit my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0462, and you'll find links to Dennis's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Does drinking coffee cause cancer? A California judge recently ordered restaurants and retailers to warn customers that drinking coffee could cause cancer. But state officials there are now saying, no, it doesn't. This bizarre situation arose because a California law requires all products that contain certain chemicals to display a cancer warning, even if the chemical appears in such a small amount as to pose no risk. The law has led to some outrageous warning labels that you may have seen on a variety of products, like the label on a fishing lure made from lead that warns, harmful if swallowed. Let's be fair. The state agency that implements that law has allowed all sorts of ridiculous warning labels over the years, but this time it says enough is enough. It's proposed a new regulation stating that drinking coffee does not pose a significant cancer risk. Could the agency soon pave the way for common sense to prevail on all warning labels? It's about time. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Summertime, and the living is easy. Unless you need bifocals, which is another story entirely, because we're talking about summer reading. Hi, Stu.
Yeah, right. Hi, Peter. You know, summertime's here, and the time is right for reading on the beach, on the balcony, maybe dancing in the streets, but we're talking about reading here, actually.
Oh, you can't dance and read at the same time. That could lead to vertigo.
Yeah. Don't try it, believe me. But on this special edition of Book Banter, because summer has just arrived, I thought maybe I'd look back at summer readings past and, you know, just share with you some of my favorite books that I read in summers past. And in particular, when I was starting to become an avid reader back in the 70s, I read paperbacks because I couldn't afford those, you know, hardcovers, which average for a price of $10. Usually, if I want to read a top bestseller, I'd wait a year, and then I'd buy it in paperback, which the average price ran between $1.75 and $2.25, with the average price going about $1.95. So I figured, you know what, I'd like to show you a selection of those paperbacks that I read during those past summers, and I've enjoyed and still enjoy to this day. And I still have them here in my library, actually.
And some of those books are?
Well, let's say if you like true crime, and I started reading true crime when I was like 12, 13 years old, and J. Robert Nash, who is a true crime writer, did this excellent encyclopedia called Blood Letters and Bad Men of some of the most notorious criminals in American history from colonial times to the 70s. Now, when the book was released by Warner Books in 1975, it was such a big book you couldn't do it in a huge pocket paperback, so they divided it into three separate editions, each with a different colored cover and a different picture on the cover. It was an excellent, thoroughly researched encyclopedia of some of the most notorious criminals in U.S. history, everyone from Jesse James to Al Capone to Charles Manson. And that got me started reading some more true crime books, including, I think, one of the best ones that was ever written, Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi. But Blood Letters and Bad Men, those three pocket volumes, started me on that road.
Okay. And following that, you also started to read when you were young. What other things in the summertime?
Well, there was Frederick Forsyth, who wrote The Day of the Jackal. He, in the mid-70s, had like a real hot streak. He had three consecutive number one bestsellers. And the one that really – I mean, Day of the Jackal is a great book, but the book I read in one summer, which was also the summer of 75, was The Odessa File. That was the second of three consecutive blockbusters, and it takes place in West Germany around 1963 at the time of the Kennedy assassination, where a young German journalist gets his diary from a Holocaust survivor who commits suicide. And he reads the diary of this survivor, and especially about this very notorious SS commandant in Latvia. And what happens is he somehow unexpectedly gets involved with the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, and finds to hunt this Nazi with the help of Simon Wiesenthal, and also about this organization called the Odessa, which harbored Nazi war criminals. It's a real fascinating book about, you know, in the Forsyth tradition, a lot of suspense, a lot of, and the ending is really a surprise, and I really enjoyed that book.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
Any others?
It was. Yeah, believe it or not, in the summer of 76, when I was 13 years old, I took the plunge and I read my first 1,000-page paperback, and that was James Clavell's Shogun. And I was very hesitant to take that challenge. It was $275, which was very expensive for a paperback back then. And you know what? I read it. It took me about a month, but I'm glad I did, because it was such a massive epic, sweeping epic, historical epic that Clavell wrote. And he wrote a lot of books about, historical books about Asia, whether it be China, Japan, Hong Kong, what have you. And if you've seen the miniseries with Richard Chamberlain, it's about a British sailor who was an employee of the Dutch, who somehow, thanks to a storm, gets swept up in Japan around 1600. And, you know, he's one of the few foreigners in that country, because there's not many foreigners were welcomed in Japan at the time. And he becomes, like I say, swept up in the traditions of Japan and becomes a shogun warrior himself, and gets the confidence of one of the major warlords in Japan at the time. Great book. Great book. I mean, you find all those traditions and historical backgrounds of the way Japan was before the Americans first traveled there in 1854. Clavell was a great writer.
So in the summertime, did you go out to play at all, or were you the prototype for Brick from the television series The Middle?
No. I played. I did, but there was a diamond in front of my old house in Ville Saint-Laurent, so like a median that was diamond shaped. So I played a lot of baseball there too. So it wasn't just sitting, you know, and reading. There was a little bit of baseball too.
When I was that age, I was more into anthologies at the time and mysteries. Mm-hmm. So I was deep into the Ellery Queen anthology series, which mm-hmm. came out every month, and also the Alfred Hitchcock mysteries, which also came out monthly. And if I wanted to read something a little more meaty, in other words, other than short stories and anthologies, and I wanted to read a full novel, it was usually something by Agatha Christie.
Oh, yeah, and Murder on the Orient Express is one of my favorites.
Sidebar, I was working as a theater usher at the time when the previous version of Murder on the Orient Express came out with Albert Finney as Hercule Poirot. And I knew that film was coming out in a few months. So I quickly got that book and read it before the movie came out. So that was one of my favorite. And it was a movie it was a movie that I worked at the theater that I was at. So I got to see it several times, but I had just read the book. So everything was fresh in my mind. And I really loved that movie and that book.
And finally, I just want to add, because I'm a big Stephen King fan, one book of his that I read, which was another brick of a book, which I read in the summer of 1982, was The Stand, which was first published in 1978, became a paperback in 1979. And it's a post-apocalyptic novel about a virus that virtually wipes out most of the United States, except for a handful of survivors, and how they try and get to a place that's not affected by the virus. And their trials and tribulations trying to get there. And I read this book in 2 weeks, and I was going through, and it helped me through when I was registering for university for the first time at Concordia University, and quite a process. And I brought that book with me during those long processes, the long registration process when I was at the Concordia's Loyola campus. So that book saw me through before I delved into one major part of my life. And it was just so worth it. I mean, I still think it's one of King's best books from the early stage of his writing career.
Okay, we're just about out of time, but I want to ask you a quick question before I let you go, and that is, you do a lot of heavy reading, literally in the types of things you read, and sometimes the size of books that you read. Do you ever get back into the light summer reading when summer rolls around, even though you do a lot of reading through the course of the year? And if the answer to that is yes, what are you reading this summer?
Well, I do try very hard to do so. And the one I want to get to read is an Agatha Christie book, Ten Little Indians, and also the original title, And Then There Were None, because that's on the PBS America Reads list. So I want to check that one out.
They're good. I read those too. Like I said, I was big into Agatha Christie when I was a kid. Always great ideas for some summer reading. But if people want to get in contact with you, perhaps ask you some other topics to kick off their summer reading period, how can they reach you, and where can they find you?
Well, they can find me first in the Montreal Times in print every Saturday, or online at www.mtltimes.ca. And if you have a question, if you want me to suggest, or if you have suggestions that you would like to share with me, you could easily email me at bookbanter@hotmail.com.
bookbanter@hotmail.com. Thank you very much, Stu.
Yeah, you're welcome, Peter. Now, time to crack some classic paperback spines.
Excellent. Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we've just about run out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a few moments, but I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you here on a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Florida family woke up confused to the sounds of workers tearing the roof off their home, and they weren't supposed to be there. Pearl Northrup said her family woke up to the loud banging of the roof being removed from the house. "Somebody is banging on my roof," Northrup said. "I thought I was getting a new roof." Northrup called her landlord, Sarah Fritchley, to ask why she wasn't warned about the project, and Fritchley revealed that no such work had been ordered. L.B. Skaggs, owner of the roofing company Nastar, said workers put the wrong address into their GPS. Meanwhile, a Michigan man faced a more severe version of a similar situation when a demolition crew mistakenly tore his house down instead of a neighboring home that was slated to be demolished. Police told Mike Anderson, the owner of the incorrectly demolished house, that someone had taken the numbers from the house slated for demolition and nailed them to his home. Well, that last story was certainly an evil plot twist, with someone actually putting the wrong address on the other house. It should be noted that both houses were vacant, and the owner of the wrongly demolished house is wondering if someone owes him a house now. I'm wondering if he had anything to do with the address switch. Just asking. Anyway, boys and girls, it's now time for the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
49-year-old Douglas Kelly of Hawthorne, Florida, called the Putnam County Sheriff's Office to tell them he had a violent reaction to the drugs he had purchased, much different from the usual reaction he had to meth, and he wanted to press charges against the drug dealer. In his effort to ensure the quality of the drug the suspect purchased, detectives told Kelly if he came to the sheriff's office, they could test the narcotic he purchased. Kelly, who detectives said was not under the influence, drove to the station and handed over the powder. Yes, he was stone cold sober. When the test confirmed it was methamphetamine, he was arrested for drug possession. Public notice, the department posted on Facebook after the arrest. If you believe you were sold bad drugs, we are offering a free service to test them for you. By the way, the drug dealer was reportedly Kelly's ex-girlfriend. And now you know why she probably dumped him. Because why? Oh, why? Would you want to go into a police station stone cold sober to have them test the quality of your meth? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0462. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0462. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. John's Barrie, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.